Thank you, everybody. Thank you all for joining this webinar. This is the fourth in our series for Africa Unconstrained, African Finance Unconstrained. This webinar is entitled From Structural Adjustment to Structural Transformation. Can the development banks change? I'm Hannah Ryder, the CEO of Development Reimagined. If you don't know Development Reimagined already, we are an international development consultancy with headquarters in China. And we also have offices in Kenya and the UK. We have launched this Africa Unconstrained flagship project, which includes this video series, and we're really happy to have you all here with us today and to explore this really important question. And the reason why we have these webinars and the different products we've produced is to explore structural answers and issues that might be constraining African economies at the moment, and how they can be how they can be shifted, and what African views might be on these sorts of issues. So to join me today, I have three fantastic guests from all over the world joining us from all over. But first, before I do that, I would like to just do a little bit of housekeeping. So for those of you that can speak Chinese or French more fluently, you're welcome to use our translation. There is live translation going on. There's a button just at the bottom that you could use. And also for those of you who I'm sure many of you are ready to, would love to ask questions of our panelists, there will be a certainly a really good opportunity to do that. So I'll encourage you be sharing your questions throughout the discussion as soon as you can. There's a Q&A, there's a Q&A button as well for you to share your questions. So please do that as we go along. Don't miss out on that opportunity. And last but not least, if you are going to be using social media to be talking about sharing your reflections on this webinar, please do that using the hashtag Africa Unconstrained. I should also say thank you very much to our partners, Quartz Africa, who have also been working with us on this series. So now let's go to our topic. Let's go to our substantive topic, and let me introduce to you our brilliant panelists. I'm going to go ladies first, of course. We have Professor Jiajun Xu, who is the Assistant Professor and Executive Deputy Dean from the Institute of New Structural Economics from Peking University. She's joining us from Beijing. She's previously worked in the United Nations and World Bank, currently acts as the General Secretary of the Global Research Consortium on Economic Structural Transformation, and she's also invited researcher at the Public Policy Research Center for the Council's Office for the State Council of China, People's Republic of China. She has written a great deal on the issues that we'll be talking about today, so I'm really pleased that she's been able to join us. She also has a PhD from the University of Oxford and has really been working extensively on international development for many, many years. So thank you, Professor Xu, for joining us. I also have Professor Howard Stein, who is a professor in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies, and also the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan. He is a development economist by profession also, educated in Canada, US and the UK, and he's taught in both Asia and Africa, and has edited more than a dozen books, collections, more than 100 journal articles, book chapters and review, and also has been very much focused on this question and in Africa, in particular on foreign aid, finance, the impact of structural adjustment, health, gender development, range of topics. Professor Howard Stein has worked on those and teaches a number of courses right now at the University of Michigan. So again, we're also very pleased to have you. Thank you for joining us so early in the morning from Michigan. Last but not least, we have Kennedy Ciccioli, who is a writer and development economist. He's based in New York and has also been working and focusing on global policy for over 15 years, worked on provided technical support to governments, private sector, civil society groups, and also working on, in particular, also working on these questions of development finance, governance, capacity and capacity building and participatory forums. So again, we're very, very glad to have him join us today. Before I ask them about this substantive question from structural adjustment to structural transformation, we go into depth about what this means, and in particular talk about the World Bank and the multilateral development bank's approaches to development, I'd like to ask our audience a little poll. And we usually ask these polls at the beginning of the webinars because it just helps us to kind of get into the topic a little bit. Let's hear what our audience think about the issues that we're about to discuss. So here's the poll. We'll be asking one right at the end of the webinar as well. This one is, do you think the World Bank currently advocates the Washington consensus with regards to development advice and financing? And you have the option of saying yes, no, or I don't know. So audience, please add your votes now, and we will see what our audience thinks. I think it could also be helpful to our panelists for understanding what our audience think. Give a couple more seconds for our audience to vote. Okay, a couple more. That'll be almost a minute to vote. All right, let's have the results. So we have 42% of the audience say yes, the World Bank currently advocates the Washington consensus. 33% say, I don't know. And 25% say no. So I think that's quite an interesting starting point for us as panelists for this discussion. And so that means it's time to go straight into it, straight into the question. I'm going to begin with Kennedy, because one of the reasons why we reached out to you as well is you wrote an article very recently in Nation Africa, which is a Kenyan newspaper, was entitled How the World Bank Misreads Africa. And I wanted to ask you about this and just give us your perspective, because the World Bank and a number of other analysts have been and continue to say that millions of African people have and will be pushed into poverty because of COVID-19, despite the fact that many African governments have been, you know, very proactive on these issues. I mean, my Development Reimagined, we did some calculations quite early on of the kinds of programs that African governments have been trying to introduce to respond to COVID-19. We calculated that those programs would reach over 175 million people if they were implemented, you know, if African governments have, these were announced policies. And we also have this question, you know, and again, World Bank and a number of highly respected economists saying that African economies are facing a debt crisis, despite the fact that levels of debt are below the levels in 1980, even levels in 1990s. So what's going on here? Why do you think that is? Why is there that disconnect in a sense?
Thank you, Anna, and good morning. Good morning, colleagues. It's my distinct pleasure to join this panel of eminent scholars, Professor Hsu and Professor Stein. Indeed, I'm glad to be here. Please allow me to start by first sharing my deepest condolences and sympathies to our brothers in the United Republic of Tanzania following the demise of their beloved president, His Excellency, Dr. John Joseph Pombe Magufuli. As you may know, we've had very few leaders of Dr. Magufuli's impact, a man who came very briefly and really shaped our understanding of African nationalism, of national pride, you know, self-reliance, political and economic autonomy. He made Tanzanians walk proudly of their country and believe in themselves. Indeed, we share in the grief of their loss and we wish them the very best as they go through their transition. Now, allow me to respond to your questions. I am a skeptic of the World Bank and its policies to Africa. The bank has been in existence for 77 years. It has been in Africa for 76 years, so just 1 year shy. It first set its roots in Africa in Egypt in 1945, and it has been there continuously for 76 years. Indeed, Africa, a continent of 54 countries, gives the World Bank a rich menu of countries that you could say, we've helped this country to develop. We've pulled this country from poverty. The bank can't say any of those things. They cannot single out a country and say, here's an example of what we've done in Africa, despite having there for almost eight decades. Let's consider what the bank has had to deal with. In Cameroon, they've worked with one president for 40 years, four decades. That level of continuity should have given the bank an opportunity to say, we worked with this regime for this long, and here is our accomplishment. They don't have that. The other low-hanging fruits, take the example of Egypt. Egypt relies on international trade route. It's very close to the heart of Europe. Egypt has a huge population, has a storied history. Still, Egypt is struggling, just like any other country in Africa. Why hasn't the World Bank and its sister institution pushed Egypt to a higher level of income? We have countries like Botswana, 2 million people, yet very rich in terms of diamond deposits. Equatorial Guinea, a low population, enormous oil wealth. Again, the World Bank cannot demonstrate how it has helped these countries that really have an advantage. Enormous resources, low population, stability, political stability to transform their lives. If indeed we cannot see any change, we cannot see any success in such countries, then what kind of hope lies there for countries like Malawi, Niger? These are landlocked, or Burundi. They're poor, they're resource poor, they're politically unstable. I fail to see how the bank can be said to be successful and even to see any future that the bank can provide for Africa. And really, as we go to discussion, we realize the bank was never really started to address African problems. It was founded on a completely different mandate. The tweaking of the mandate does not respond directly to African needs. Take the case of the current corona pandemic and the assessment that Africa is overburdened and now more people are gonna fall into poverty. Indeed, that's true. However, my reading suggests that this has nothing to do with COVID-19 pandemic. Already there was signs that Africa was falling into poverty and desperation, food shortages. Half of African countries are either failing or they're failed states. Low income countries like Kenya, for example, that has shown some sign of prospect of growth, they are faced with serious challenges. Just to put it in perspective, Kenya collects its national budget is about 3 trillion shillings. It collects 2 trillion from taxes, of which 1 trillion is earmarked to pay off That's the interest financing on the debt they have collected. So right there, Kenya is facing a shortfall of 1 trillion shillings, with only 1 trillion left for recurring expenditure. This has nothing to do with COVID, even though COVID has contributed to that. We already knew that these problems were coming years ago when Kenyan government engaged in this and controlled spending on infrastructure, yet the economy wasn't growing. There was zero employment opportunities despite these big loans. So the bank cannot really provide these simplistic answers that yes, Africa is faced with challenges because of debt and because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Africa still remains in systemic poverty because the root causes of its challenges have never been fixed. And the bank knows this. They have not really updated their mandate. While Africa's problems continue to manifest themselves readily, the bank has not updated its tools. It continues giving the same strategies that have been given Africa for the last 76 years. In the study, in the article which you referenced earlier on, I really looked at the latest report on Africa published in 2019. With the exception of a focus on population dynamics, the World Bank was giving the same prescription it gave Africa 30 years ago in 1989, almost word for word, same prescriptions. Yet we know Africa as a continent, the population has grown tremendously. There are more challenges. Africa finds itself in a highly competitive environment. Its resources are still there. Why isn't Africa or the World Bank giving Africa new tools, new thinking mentality? So I am excited to be taking part in this because really I feel there are opportunities for Africa. And if and whether the bank and its sister organization can restructure to respond to the growing challenges in Africa is something that is really worth discussion. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Kennedy. And I think what I want to explore as well is kind of why? Why hasn't things changed? Why haven't things changed? But before we do that, let me ask Professor Xu Jiajun. You've worked in the World Bank. You also work very closely with Professor Justin Yifu Lin, who was the chief economist of the World Bank for several years. And if we're talking about new approaches to development, new approaches and thinking, I think that was one of the ambitions, certainly, of Justin Yifu Lin and what you do now as well. What would you say in terms of the World Bank advice and financing and development, what do you think can be improved around in terms of that advice? What should be changing, or do you think it has changed already?
Well, thank you very much, Hannah. I'm very delighted to have the opportunity to join the webinar today. At the beginning of our webinar, we have an audience poll. It's very interesting to see that a majority of the audience still believe that the World Bank today is still advocating the free market approach, or so-called Washington consensus. So for me, you know, the answer to your question at the beginning, you know, is the World Bank still pursuing the free market approach policy? I think the answer is both yes and no. Because on the strategy level, you know, the then World Bank president, Wolfensohn, has already said that the Washington consensus is dead back in 2004. But, you know, on the actual practice and policy level, the World Bank today is still to a great extent pursuing a one-size-fits-all policy framework. Mm-hmm. And this policy framework has a built-in bias in favor of the free market approach. So I can give you a concrete example. So in the World Bank, they have a country policy and institutional assessment framework, so-called CPIA. So CPIA is very powerful. So it's a uniformed benchmark that will give score to countries to see whether you are a good performer or a bad performer in terms of the quality of your policies and institutions. If you are a good performer, you can get more aid from World Bank IDA, the International Development Association, which is a soft loan window of the World Bank Group. So this framework is very problematic from the perspective of new structure economics. The reason is that, you know, this framework has an underlying assumption that there is a blueprint for any countries, regardless of their development stages. So, you know, there's a lot of rethinking about this one-size-fits-all approach. Even the World Bank Independent Evaluation Group, when they evaluated CPIA, they have highlighted that, you know, CPIA have ignored the importance of different stages in deciding the good policies. But unfortunately, you know, CPIA is still a prevailing framework in the World Bank Group today and still shaping the allocation of resources. So for me, you know, I'm from the Institute of New Structural Economics. What we really want to do is to rethink this mainstream approach and to encourage to bring the structural difference between developed countries and developing countries into the analytical framework of modern economics. So what we really want to do is first, we really want to bring economic transformation at the forefront of economic debate. Even though health and education, which are important, but they are not sufficient to alleviate the poverty reduction on a sustainable manner and on a large scale. So in the past 4 decades, you know, China has lifted 800 million people out of poverty, and economic transformation is a driving engine behind it. This is the first, bring economic transformation to the center. And the second, it's very important. The second point is to, you know, try to encourage a synergy between an effective market and a facilitating government. So the government need to play a very proactive role in the development process and in promoting industrial upgrading and economic transformation. And the third very important point from the perspective of new structural economics is that while a country tries to develop, you should try to focus on what you have. What, in terms of factory endowment, for example, if you are labor abundant countries, you should try to focus on labor intensive industries instead of aiming high to some kind of capital intensive industry, which may define your competitive advantage. And then based on what you have, you can focus what you can do well in the global economy. So, and by doing so, you can gradually find the appropriate institutional arrangement for your economy. For example, at the early stage, maybe the best approach is not to develop, to deepen your capital market. Instead, if you have so many SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprise in your economy, and maybe small and local banks can be a better approach to serve the real economy and to support economic growth. So this is what we really want to bring some new thinking into the mainstream approach. And by doing so, we do hope that, you know, in this field of international development, we will not suffer from the poverty of alternatives. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Professor Xu. And I think this is a really important point, you know, this question of alternatives. Are there alternatives there? Are there, and you've presented one alternative. And, you know, I was trained as a development economist too, and when I was trained, we talked about at least 6 different approaches to development. Why does it seem that there is just one approach? And Professor Stein, I want to come to you here because I mean, you've also been exploring this question for a long time and encouraging World Bank to take, and multilateral development banks to take different approaches to development. And you also came out with a piece just a few hours ago that was published called The Pathology of Economics. And in the context of COVID-19 as well, and the whether responses have been standard or not standard, what do you think that helps us to learn, and what role have the World Bank and multilaterals played in COVID-19 management? And is it linked? The kinds of issues that Kennedy was also mentioning earlier, are those linked to this very narrow economic approach?
Thank you very much, Hannah. That's quite a long list of things to attempt to examine in a very short time. And let me throw a few ideas out. Basically, I want to just back up a little bit and talk a bit about the history of the World Bank. Because the World Bank at one point in time, and this is in line with the op-ed I've just published with Africa as a Country, once upon a time, the World Bank was actually very much dominated by engineers and finance people in the 50s and 60s. And that's when the World Bank was in the business of doing what China does a lot right now, which is building infrastructure in Africa. And I'd argue that during that period of time, the bank did a better job in the sense of actually getting at the fundamentals of what is central, which is of course the mainstay of any development is having efficiently operating a wide network of infrastructure for a multifaceted set of purposes. And that was forgotten. Unfortunately, what happened is the bank became dominated by economists during the Woods period and increasingly thereafter. You then had the importation, you know, with Ann Kruger, former chief economist of World Bank, and the switch in the international focal point under the Reagan administration and Thatcher administration, and a movement towards this kind of neoliberal economics, neoliberal policy based upon neoclassical economics. And so in my view, when the bank had more engineers, or even in the 1970s, when they had somewhat more open-minded economists that drew on a multifaceted set of approaches like the great work of Francis Stewart, now retired from Oxford, on basic needs, where they focused on the issues of rural integrated development and focusing on agricultural investment. They saw that the market doesn't operate very well, that forms of national planning as centralized allocation of state-focused industrial policy were absolutely important. Was it an era in which the bank was in some senses more effective in Africa and elsewhere? Although I'd argue that there were some issues as well there with the issues of debt creation and still some conditionality. But when the World Bank moved into this mode, reflecting the transformation of the economics profession into neoclassical economics, you had this enormous narrowing of the bank. And I would argue that, to agree with Professor Sue to some extent, you know, that still very much is driving the thinking in the World Bank. You know, we've just recently examining the randomized controlled trials of the bank, which is kind of cats meow, to see if it actually is making an impact in the transformation of the bank thinking beyond this kind of set of neoliberal focal points. And I argued not, and largely because it's brought in the kind of new microeconomics, micro development economics, which is very much, I think, a kind of warmed over and moderate reflection of some of the behavioral economic transformation, but still is basically based upon the fundamentals of neoclassical economics, which is highly methodological individualist, and focused on this kind of notion of homo economicus and utility maximization, and forgetting about the whole nature of the concatenation, the nature of the underlying social dynamics that are in fact by nature conceive economies in a way in which you begin to transform things on a much higher level, a much more concatenated level than looking and focusing on somehow individual incentives having a big transformation, which has been the heart of neoclassical economics. So, and you can see that in the doing business and some of the crisis that's created in the banks, which was just kind of warmed over neoclassical economics, the same of neoliberal focal points on doing things like reducing regulations. There never was a very cogent set of papers empirically, in my view, that said that, you know, doing business indicators really leads to a dramatic change of the types of things that are needed in Africa to kind of just play up Kennedy's points. the lack of really addressing the fundamental challenges in Africa, and that continues to this very, very moment. So I'd argue is that the biggest problem is that, I mean, there's really twofold here. One is not only the continued domination of neoclassical economics, and here, you know, as much as I have a great respect to with Professor Lin, you know, I think basically one of the big problems with the new structural economics basically is this focus on static comparative advantage. It's still very much, and we've had a bit of a discussion on this issue in the original exchange with Professor Haijun Chang in an interesting debate some years ago of Cambridge University, that basically here the focal point was on, can you actually transform structural adjustments, which really should be in some senses the very nature of development, not getting stuck in what the structural adjustment system is. But that's a long discussion we can have. So to summarize, I don't think the bank has changed very much. I think that the approach they've taken with COVID is sort of just piling additional debt on Africa rather than getting at the fundamentals of it. We can perhaps talk about the debt situation a little bit more systematically a bit later. But you know, in my view, there are a number of countries that are in deep trouble in Africa. You can't just summarize every single country in the same platform, but you know, for example, a country like Zambia, which now has, of course, defaulted on the sovereign bond issue, is an issue we look at with some of my colleagues in detail, has created a situation where, you know, they really are going to need debt relief. There is no possible way you can get out of the current ratios, you know, and I think the key ratio, and I think really needs to be emphasized, is the relationship between debt and exports. And I think I was just looking at the 2019 data, and they're already at about, you know, 3.6, which is just way above any possibility of kind of actually exporting way out of it. So I'll be quiet there a bit more, but I would just summarize, as I have in this, this op-ed I've just produced, it's necessary to get back to thinking about development by going beyond neoclassical economics to bring in a whole array of theoretical tools, which we have, which once formed the basis of what was development economics, which is multi-paradigmatic, a multifaceted approach, and also having no hesitancy in working closely with other disciplines in conceptualizing the extant issues in Africa.
Thank you, Professor Stein. And you know, I think before we go into the question of how that narrowing and that lack of multi-paradigm thinking affects World Bank and multilateral development bank approaches in some cases, I want to go into this question a little bit more of why. Why is there such a very slim focus, narrow focus on the new, and I want to ask Kennedy this question. One of the things my team were looking at as we were preparing for this webinar was, for instance, World Bank's diversity policy. And there's not a great deal of data, for instance, on World Bank's diversity. Supposedly, the articles of agreement suggest that the World Bank is meant to focus on geographical areas and geographical diversity rather than perhaps, and so they collect information on nationalities rather than race, for instance. So there have been some independent studies of diversity at the World Bank, and a 2009 study, so things could have changed a great deal in over 10 years. A 2009 study suggested that of the of those in of World Bank staff in the US, 4 out of 1,000 employees were Black. That was 2009. Now, do you think diversity has anything to do with this approach? I think Kennedy will have some specific views on that, and Professor Stein might also, given your recent op-ed. Kennedy, what's your thinking on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very important observation, Hannah. It's very frustrating that Africa, a continent of 1.3 billion people, cannot be looked to provide solution to our own problems. The World Bank remains very Eurocentric, very Western focused. It maintains this client relationship with Africa, dictating to Africa what needs to be done, coming up with all these models and technical terms. And you know, it shouldn't be that complicated. Here's a continent, one of the biggest continents on the planet, with only a modest 1.3 billion people, a very rich and diverse continent. For 80 years, certain things have been very certain in Africa. Number one, the population has grown. Poverty has become endemic. Yet Africa continues to lose billions of dollars through illicit financial flows. Africa's minerals, diamonds and gold and oil, continue to be exploited with very little in return. The best lands in Africa continue to grow coffee and tea for foreigners when Africa cannot feed her own people. Why isn't the bank focusing on these things? Why is the bank still talking about, you know, trading and capacity building and these small projects when we know these people are potentially very rich? They have all this wealth. They are smart. There's no single university in the world, and I've tried looking, that you will not find an eminent scholar from the African continent in any field. So Africa are smart. And to deal with economies, you don't really require economists per se. You will need people from all academia fields. And Africa has that, has this brain power that the World Bank continues to ignore. Again, in my piece that I wrote on the latest report that was published by the bank in 2019, none of the contributors came from Africa. 13 people contributed, but not a single one came from Africa. How do you entertain such that you have foreigners in this age still advising Africa what to do when Africans are able, they have all the willpower, the knowledge to really look at the problem and provide solutions? Now, the reason why you have all this problem that is ongoing is because, really, like I said, the bank wasn't founded to help Africa. The World Bank was founded for reconstruction of Europe. And like Professor Stein said, it will start by engineers, because the need at the time was to reconstruct Europe. They needed engineers. Now that you're looking at Africa, engineers are no longer there. We have people coming to our villages, telling us on how to boil water so we don't avoid getting diarrhea. This is common sense stuff. This is public public health stuff that our government should be doing. The World Bank should be doing stuff like that. They should be doing the heavy lifting. They aren't doing the heavy lifting because, again, they're foreigners who are offering Africa solutions, sort of asking Africans to solve their own problems. Now, the structure of the World Bank itself excludes poor countries from being at the table. The biggest shareholders are Western countries. And when they meet to talk about their policies, their direction, none of the African voices is ever heard at the table. And this really cascades to the leadership, to the professional, to the people working for those banks. Key decision makers, none of them is African. They might have one or two people, but that's barely enough to make a difference. As long as our brothers and sisters from Africa working in these institutions respond to the dictates of outsiders, Africa will continue spinning its wheels. There is a serious need for reform. And really, one of the challenges for the bank is that it has serious accountability problems. It doesn't report to anyone. The World Bank is funded by the taxpayers in Western countries, and those taxpayers have zero idea what the World Bank does. It never gives reports to the taxpayers in the US, for example, that here's your money that you gave us, and this is what we did with the money. The World Bank is not accountable to the poor African countries either. They never come and tell Kenya or Zimbabwe or Nigeria that in the last year we spent so much money, and this is how many people we helped move from poverty to better standards of living. Now, if any company that has this kind of free reign that is not accountable to any of the constitutions or constituencies, it will never reform. It will never push to be better, but it'll continue doing the same things, getting bigger, spending more money with absolutely no returns. When you look at the reports of the World Bank themselves, the internal evaluations, rarely do you see an admission that their projects have failed. is always saying the projects have made their targets, they have achieved whatever they set up to do. And if that were true, then Africa and the countries in which the World Bank has a presence should be reflecting those outcomes. But I doubt there's any single country in the world that the World Bank can say, we help this country and we are proud of it. Not Jamaica, not Haiti, not Nepal, not Pakistan, none of those countries. If anything, countries that have pushed forward, certainly China, India, Brazil, they have done this best of their own smart leadership. It's not rocket science to end poverty. It's not rocket science for countries to have balanced budget. The bank should be helping countries like African countries to stop these people from looting their resources. The World Bank should be helping Africa to stop people from illicit financial flows. We have enough resources to develop Africa, but as long as the bank is offering us lip service and we continue losing our resources to outsiders, the story will never change. We will be spinning wheels and talking about these economic models and policies, but the outcome will certainly be the same.
Right, Professor Xu, you talk about structural transformation. What would it do if, for instance, the World Bank did take a structural transformation approach? Would that help if there was, you know, for example, the diversity of thought for that to happen? How would that shift thinking in terms of development and in terms of thinking about debt and financing? What do you think would be the different perspective? And again, Professor Stein, feel free to come in here as well. But I'd really like to hear from Professor Xu on this question. And let me also remind the audience as well, please do share your questions. We will have time for a Q&A, so put your questions into the Q&A to our panelists, because this is your opportunity. Otherwise, I'll keep using the chair's moderator's prerogative. Professor Xu.
Well, thank you, Hannah. So your question is, if the World Bank takes structural transformation as its core mandate, how would it do things differently? So I think there are at least two things that the World Bank can do it differently. The first thing is that the World Bank should move beyond getting institutions right to help the country to build their competitive advantage in the global economy. As I mentioned earlier, there's no one-size-fits-all good policy framework for every country in the world, regardless of their different stages. Therefore, in order to help to achieve structural transformation, the World Bank needs to work together with the country to help to identify what the country has. For example, if Ethiopia is very abundant in labor, and the World Bank should help the Ethiopian government to attract foreign direct investment, to build the capacity, and be able to help Ethiopia to export goods in the global market. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is that the overall institutional framework is weak in Ethiopia. If you look at the doing business indicators, Ethiopia may be ranked very low in the ranking. Then how can the World Bank help Ethiopia government to overcome this funding constraint? And one solution may be that the World Bank can help Ethiopia government to build special economic zones, to build industry parks, and to help to improve the hard and soft infrastructure within the zone. And then they can build the confidence of investors, and they can build the brand of Made in Africa, Made in Ethiopia. And gradually, they can help to scale up the impact and to help to build the productive capacity of the country. So I think this is very important. Instead of try to improve the institutional environment nationwide within a very short period of time, we should try to do things pragmatically and try to achieve quick wins.
But would that
mean? And then we have the snowballing effect.
Yes. Would that mean a different approach, for example, to thinking about debt finance? and what it means, certain levels of debt, or would it also mean a different approach to the Doing Business Index? I mean, I also noticed that there is a review taking place of the Doing Business Index right now. And again, just like Kennedy was saying with another the COVID-19 analysis, no Africans on that review. Would there be, and also no Chinese people actually, are there certain parts of kind of core World Bank advice which might actually change? And with regards to debt, if you used structural transformation approach?
This is actually leading me to my second point, where the World Bank can do things differently. So when it comes to the debt analysis, it is true that many African countries today is facing debt distress. And there's a lot of discussion that taking place, talking about what we can do to help to tackle these debt problems. But for me, I think before we make prescriptions, it's very important to get the diagnosis right. So in order to get the diagnosis right, we need to distinguish two things. One is liquidity crisis, and the other is sovereignty crisis. So what do I mean by liquidity crisis? So liquidity crisis occurs when a country is facing a temporary cash flow problems. And then, what do I mean by sovereignty crisis? It means that the country may have debt that they do not have, they cannot meet by using their asset. So currently, after COVID-19, a lot of foreign capitals has fled away from the African continent. So this actually has partly contributed to the liquidity problems that are facing by many countries today. So I'm talking about the sovereignty crisis. I think what matters here is not about the levels of debt, how much debt do you have, but rather what matters is the usage of debt. Do you use debt? Do you borrow for short-term consumptions, or do you borrow to make investment? When you make investment, do you invest in the white elephant project that are very expensive but generate very little economic benefit? Or do you invest in industries that are in line with your latent competitive advantage? So therefore, you know, from the perspective of new structural economics, it's very important to bring, you know, the structure of debt usage into the analysis of the, you know, the debt sustainability analysis. Mm-hmm. And along that line of thinking, so it's also important to, you know, to analyze the impact of transformative infrastructure project upon long-run economic growth. Because currently, you know, the current World Bank debt sustainability framework, you know, it came into being in 2006, called NCBP, non-concessional borrowing policy. At that time, they posed a uniform debt limit upon all countries. So this is very problematic. And later on, you know, emerging market and African leaders came together to call for more flexibility in this debt framework. And in 2010, they introduced more flexibility, but I think there's still a long way to go in order to analyze, you know, how we can better use the foreign debt for economic transformation in the long run. And then they can improve the debt service capacity of African countries in the long run.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's a really great answer, because and it really echoes a lot of points that many others have been making in this series of webinars. And in particular, this question about this shift in focus on the quantity of debt rather than looking instead at the quality of debt. And that seems to come out in a lot of conversations that we have. And Professor Stein, what's your view on these questions?
There are a lot of things said here, and I don't want to take too much time, and so many issues have been raised. Let me begin with the issue of the debt analysis. And one of the, of course, great economists that maybe some mainstream economists are finally discovering is Hyman Minsky. You know, and Minsky basically raised the issue of financial fragility, which is generally used in the private sector, but it can also be utilized and applied the situation of analyzing international debt. Of course, the underlying dynamics of financial fragility is income is uncertain, but debt is certain. And that's the great problem. And so as we begin to look at, and this gets to the fundamental issue of African, the dynamics of African development currently, which is that every time the debt piles up, it will stay and accumulate. But the problem is that African countries today are still very much mired in the vicissitudes of commodity prices. And I'd argue today, and I think it's, I've done that in some writing, is a lot of commodity is driven today, not by the actual users of that commodity, but by massive amounts of speculation and hedge fund money, which began after the liberalization in 1999 in the US, which allowed basically hedge funds and speculative money to run into these large commodity markets in Chicago and elsewhere to drive the price. And so we have a situation where African countries have no control over what is going to transpire with their main products, because most of these products are unprocessed raw materials. By the UNCTAD data, some are over 90%, in which basically every single time these global hedge funds say, we want to put more of our money into dollars instead of oil, oil prices begin to tank. And you have to understand this global dynamic that's behind this. And as long as African countries are stuck in a situation where they're the price takers in a world in which they have no control over, it'll create the situation of this fragility. This debt crisis is going to continue as it has without this transformation. So the question becomes, how do you move away? And I think probably Professor Xu and I would agree in the sense that there has to be a major structural transformation. How we do it, of course, is different. I would argue, as I'm working on a book currently for Oxford on the issue of institutions and industrial policy in Africa. And it really has to do drawing what I'd say is four components. And I don't have time to get into a lecture on them. And the four theoretical components would be structural economics, institutional economics, and the original economics, not the new institutional approach. The issue of the development state, how you actually form states to be able to focus on development. And finally, a literature called the capabilities literature. And this is all well-developed, interesting theory that is all non-neoclassical. And these are the kind of tools that Africans need to begin to think about building up the capabilities. And capacities are not simply also on the issue of the private market and the private sector, which is very important. It's also the capabilities of the state and how you build those capabilities in a manner which is consistent with the dynamics of what is needed also in the private sector development. And we've entirely moved away from that kind of broad thinking theoretically. So I don't want to get into, I want to make one last really quick point, which is the issue of the African presence among the economists. And we've lost two great African economists, right? And both have been friends and colleagues at various stages in my life. One was Benu Ndulu, who was my colleague many years ago when we talked together in the economics department at the University of Dar es Salaam, and my good friend Sandika Makandaweri, two absolutely brilliant African economists with very different approaches. I would argue that Benno was incredibly well-respected and had a big influence, associated with the beginnings of the African Economic Research Consortium, but transformed Africa in a way which was very problematic, as I've argued, has pushed it much more into the adoption of neoclassical economics, away from this multi-paradigmatic approach theoretically, which is, in my view, needed to be able to deal with the tools of the challenges in Africa, versus Tandika, who was much more in line with thinking broadly institutional economics, multi-paradigmatic, being critical of what he called monocropping in model institutions, this kind of singular theoretical approach, which was so problematic, which was originally pointed out by the great economist Albert Hirschman, basically talked about the idea of model economics and the need to get beyond that. And so that becomes an incredibly important point, is understanding the need to kind of move forward in a way of rethinking and reconceptualizing what is transpiring currently in Africa. There's many other things I could say. I'll stop there because we're running out of time.
Yeah, and I think it's time as well to move to our Q&A session with the audience. We've had a couple of questions come in, and I really want to see what your responses are to them. I'll just introduce two of the questions. The first one is, how can the younger generation prepare to lift and prepare African people to lift themselves out of poverty. African countries are continuously being exploited. How to mitigate this in the future? So how can the future generation be prepared to eradicate this issue? So that's question number one. And then the other question is, and I think very helpfully providing some useful nuance here, what about the approaches of regional development banks? So if the World Bank is so hard to change and so set in its ways, perhaps, you know, so much of a road to go, could regional banks lead the way? Yes, they have a lot less capital than the World Bank, but perhaps they could help. So this is from Saad Siddiqui from University of Cambridge. Thank you so much for your question. Those two questions, who would like to go first? Kennedy, should we go to you since we haven't heard from you for a little while?
Yeah, thank you. I think those are great questions. The first part, and this is my message to the young people in Africa. The future belongs to the young people, and the future begins now. It's appalling that Africa, which is a very youthful continent, is looking to retirees, people who are in the 70s, 80s, to shape their future. What does history teach us? History will show us that Nelson Mandela took to the street when he was young, when he was advocating for change. Martin Luther Jr., Malcolm X, if you're Christian, Jesus Christ, if you are Ghanaian, Guruma. All these were young people in their 20s when they were fighting off enemies for progress, when they were agitating for change. I strongly believe that you could pick any country in Africa where the young people are the majority, that they have the power among themselves, within themselves, to ask for change, to force those regimes to listen to them, to overthrow those regimes and bring in a new paradigm. You cannot sit back and wait for these people who are fabulously wealthy and whose own obsession is just to amass wealth for themselves and their families to bring change for you. Certainly these young people face a difficult, challenging challenge because they cannot find jobs. I'll give you a statistic for the case of Kenya. That to show you how dire the situation is in Kenya. Every year, about 1 million young people in Kenya turn 18. 1 million people. Of those, 300,000 come out with a sort of education, either a certificate, a diploma, a master's, a doctorate degree. 300,000 out of 1 million. The 700,000, perhaps high school or no education at all. Now, in 2019, before COVID, Kenya's economy created only 70,000 jobs. This is both public and private sector, 70,000 jobs. So if you have an education of some sort, of the 300,000, only 70,000 will get a job. 230,000 educated Kenyans have no chance of getting any decent employment. You have 700,000 who stand no chance at all of getting any employment. What are the Kenyan government doing? Absolutely nothing. This is not a crisis for them. Yet this is a situation that is replicated in every single country in Africa. Young people need to wake up. Young people need to realize that they are the Mandelas now. They can bring the change that they so desire. The second part is the regional development banks. They're too small to matter. The African Development Bank, for example, is really an offshoot of the World Bank. It does the same thing World Bank tells them to do. They have the same thinking, the same mindset, the same philosophy when it comes to approaching Africa. They cannot think outside the box. Unless you get an institution that is truly rooted in the South, that is a truly African institution that responds directly to the needs. These are the regional banks that are in our region, but really they're just offshoots of the World Bank, will continue reflecting the World Bank interest, which in this case will be responding to the needs of the shareholders, supply-driven, demand-driven policies.
Thank you. Professor Xu, what do you think about these questions?
Well, I would like to take the second question regarding the potential of regional development banks in doing things differently. if the World Bank is very hard to change. I think there are two types of regional development banks. The first type is so-called traditional regional development banks, which were established after the World War II, and where the shareholders, the predominant shareholders, are developed countries, such as US. For example, you know, in the Inter-American Development Bank, US is still the largest shareholder. And for these traditional regional development banks, they often follow the steps and follow the policy of the World Bank. Normally, you know, when the US try to introduce certain kind of policy change, they will try to achieve the initial success in the World Bank and then ask other traditional regional development banks to follow suit. So if the governance structure does not change, it's very difficult for the traditional RDBs, regional development banks, to do things differently. The other type of RDBs is the recently emerging regional development banks, where the share, which has been initiated by emerging market, and also emerging market as a major shareholders on their board of executive directors, such as the BRICS New Development Bank and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And I think there may be hope that, you know, these banks may have different ideas regarding the role of the state in the economic development. So they may translate into an alternative policy approach, but these institutions are still very young. So we still need to wait and see to see whether they can do things differently and bring some fresh perspectives.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. Johanna. Thank you, Professor Xu. And it's also
worth saying something quickly.
Yes, you may. Okay. Go ahead.
I know we're running out of time. Basically, I want to address again the fundamental issue. I was just, my most recent trip to Africa, unfortunately, it's been now over a year, was to the African Development Bank. So I was in Abidjan for that purpose. And I would just like to echo both positions that the bank there is a little different than the World Bank. I mean, there's been some attempt, some of the leadership to maybe push in a different direction. And it comes also to the issue of the youth. And that is that there has to be a kind of reorientation of thinking and training and education and economics to begin to kind of look much more broadly at a set of tools, to be able to see the state not as an enemy, but to see how you can adapt the state and mechanism that it assists in the process. It's a kind of rethinking, reconceptualization. But, you know, I've lectured all over the place now in economics departments in different parts of Africa now for many years. And it's the same thing these days. They're trained exactly the same way as my students here at the University of Michigan that, you know, get their introductory economics classes. There's no difference. It's the same, microeconomic that has no relationship to reality. It's ideology. It's not really any systematic analysis of tools that allow you to understand the world around you. And so I think one of the crucial things is both for the youth as well as for these industrial banks, or for these regional banks, is there has to be a rethinking, a reset of tools, a retraining, in some cases a re-educating or a deprogramming in some cases of neoclassical economics into using a whole set of other tools. Incredibly important. And what I'd argue is that in some senses we have to think a bit beyond the regional bank concept and get back to the original notion of development banks and industrial banks, which we know have been so important in the history of Japan and in China, in throughout East and Southeast Asia, you know, and at various points even in African history. It's the idea, very simply, that you have to have, and this is, of course, was the basis of the East Asian Miracle Study, which was pushed by Japan, and I was in Japan certainly after that as a visiting professor in the 90s. But what you have is the notion that, you know, is you have to have an assumption of risk, you know, in the very nature of the loan process to the private sector, if you can build industrialization. Because by nature, banks, and, you know, I've written on this as well, banks by nature are risk averse. You have to find mechanism which the state assumes that risk, because industrialization is enormously productive and pays off enormously in raising the standard of living and generating the kind of jobs that Kennedy refers to, which are so needed in African countries. But it also is a very risky proposition. And in order to get to the long term and beyond the kind of short term risk aversion that's typically of bankers, you have to begin to change the nature of the socialization of risk in these countries. Anyway, I'll shut up at this point, but the, you know, there's many, many issues here embedded in this.
I think, you know, honestly, we could talk on these issues for such a long time, and I'm really pleased that we had those questions, because I think they've got us to some really great insights from all of you. I'm gonna ask you all to say one very short sentence in response to my last question. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of re-ing, and so I'm going to say, if we were to advise African leaders, if you were to advise African leaders now what to do with respect to reimagining the role of the World Bank or multilateral development banks in Africa's development process, what would you how would you suggest they proceed? What should African leaders do or say? Kennedy, you go first.
Africa's problems really are political, not economic, not financial, not ideological, but political. African leaders need to lobby Brussels, need to lobby Washington, D.C., need to lobby New York, and have real change. This change is possible. We cannot sit and talk about same problems for 70, 80 years without seeing any results. So Africa needs to really go to Europe, needs to go to the U.S. and demand change.
Okay. Professor Xu?
So to make the partnership with multilateral development banks works, self-reliance is a key. So if I want to quote, you know, what the leader Deng Xiaoping said when China tried to join the World Bank and to negotiate the World Bank support for China back in the early 1980s, what Deng Xiaoping said is as follows. With the World Bank, China can grow faster. Without World Bank, China still can develop its own economy. I think self-reliance is very important, and African leaders should be on the driver's seat.
Yeah. Okay, be in the driving seat. Lobby for change, be in the driving seat. Professor Stein, you've got the last word.
What I'd say basically is it comes down to power, and it comes down to understanding the dynamics of power inside the World Bank. And what I'd say basically, it's time to actually talk about who the World Bank has been operating for, who are the winners and losers from that, and begin to challenge and rethink the very nature of the dynamics of these international institutions and the role they need to play in the development process.
Okay, so yes, push for change as well. That's rethink from Professor Stein. Thank you all so much. I'm going to, before we finish, we've got one last thing to do, which is to ask our audience what they think and how they have, what they assess for the future. Let's have that last poll. We have the question, in light of the SDGs and COVID-19, do you think the World Bank, multilateral development banks approaches ought to be reformed? From the discussion you've had today, do you think the answer is yes, as soon as possible? Two, I don't think it will make any difference, even if they were. Or three, no way, they have the right approaches for the future. What does the audience think after our fascinating and in-depth conversation? Let's give the audience a few more seconds, before we close to come in. Should there be reform? Okay, almost done. Maybe a couple more seconds there. All right, let's close the poll. We have our answer. Wow, that's pretty strong. We have yes as soon as possible from 85% of our audience say yes. And we have equal numbers, 8% on I don't think it will make any difference or no way. So there we go. Very clear endorsement for rethinking, reimagining. Thank you all. Thank you so much to our panelists for joining us today. This has been a really fantastic discussion. Very insightful, and I'm really pleased that we're able to hold it. Please, audience, do remember we have another webinar in this series coming up in just a few days. It will be on Tuesday, 23rd of March. Please don't miss it. We'll be looking at another of these options for reimagining Africa's debt system, looking at how African countries can actually come together themselves to deal with debt challenges. So please don't miss it. Please do sign up for that as soon as you've signed out of this seminar. And thank you all so much again for joining. Thank you to our panelists and thank you to our great audience for some brilliant questions as well.
And thank you, Hannah, for being a brilliant host.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Hannah.
Take care and good evening, everybody.
Bye now.
Take care.
And good morning from the rest of us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.